All right, so welcome everyone. Today we are diving deep into a case that on the surface seems, you know, pretty straightforward, but trust me, it gets pretty interesting. It's Broadus v. Commercial National Bank. It's all about unpaid rent, a claim that a landlord was negligent, and $25 goes missing. And by the end of this, you'll really have a much better understanding of when a landlord could actually be held responsible for stuff that belongs to a tenant.
Yeah, absolutely. And the materials we're working from here are pretty comprehensive. We've got excerpts from podcast guidance, detailed case briefs, you know, the standard brief, and even one focused on a perplexity analysis, all laser-focused on this 1925 decision from the Oklahoma Supreme Court. So we get to really see this legal issue from, like, all sides.
So before we get into all the legal stuff, let's set the scene. In Broadus, you've got these landlords, Commercial National Bank, and a woman named Johnella Barnes, and they're going after their tenants, Broadus and Ambrister, for like $115 in back rent. And, you know, the tenants weren't saying they didn't owe anything, but they hit back with a counterclaim saying they were out $25, stolen right out of their office safe over a weekend.
Right. And what really makes this interesting, what really kicks off the whole legal fight, is why these tenants thought the landlord should be held accountable. You see, their main argument was all about the landlords being negligent, not providing enough security. They pointed to the fact that while the janitors had access to the office and that the landlords themselves, get this, had their own keys to the place.
But there's this twist, and it's a huge twist. It's what the court really latched onto when making their decision, and it's super important for, you know, understanding landlord-tenant law in general. The tenants, get this, they also had their own keys, like full unrestricted access to their office, 24/7. So keep that little detail in mind as we get into the legal weeds here.
Yeah, for sure. So the tenants are thinking, look, your people had access, you had keys, our money's gone, so you got to pay up. Their strategy was to argue that, legally speaking, the whole landlord-tenant situation created this thing called a bailment. They were saying that's what made the landlords responsible for keeping their stuff safe in that office.
Okay, so let's break down this bailment thing. What exactly does that mean when we're talking about, like, the law?
So at its core, a bailment happens when someone, the bailer, gives their property to someone else, the bailee, for a specific reason, with the understanding that they'll get it back. In this case, the Oklahoma Supreme Court was super clear that there are three things that have to be present for a bailment to exist. First, the property actually has to be handed over. Second, the bailee has to have exclusive control over that property. And third, the bailee has to have, like, sole custody of it.
And it sounds like that second piece, exclusive control, that's where the tenant's argument really fell apart, am I right?
Spot on. The court really zeroed in on this idea of exclusive control. Their logic was pretty simple. Because the tenants still had that unrestricted access to their office, you know, they had their own keys, could go in, whatever that meant. The landlords just didn't have the kind of control over the office or the stuff in it, like the safe and the $25 that you absolutely need for a bailment to exist legally.
We were looking at the case brief, and there's this quote from the court that really hits the nail on the head. They said, such a delivery of property must be made to the bailee as will entitle him to exclude for the period of the bailment the possession thereof, even of the owner. Sounds pretty cut and dry.
Yeah.
If the owner can still come and go as they please, it's like impossible to say someone else has exclusive control.
That's the crux of it, right?
Yeah.
The tenants could always get into their office, and that completely undercut their whole claim that the landlords had this exclusive possession thing you need for a bailment. Think of it this way. If you loan someone your car, they have exclusive control for that time. But if you and a buddy both have keys to, say, a storage unit, neither of you has that same legal kind of exclusive control. That's the same principle at play in Broadus.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So no bailment. But the tenants also said the landlords were negligent, that they didn't do enough to protect their stuff. How'd the court handle that argument?
Well, now we're talking about this legal idea called the burden of proof. In a negligence case, the person making the accusation here, the tenants they have, to prove that the other side, the landlords, messed up, and that their mess up directly caused whatever loss they suffered.
So what evidence did they actually bring to the table to try and show the court that, yeah, the landlords had been negligent?
See, that's where the tenant's negligence claim really falls flat. The court basically said they didn't provide enough solid evidence to show that the landlord's being negligent actually caused the theft. There were no signs of, like, forced entry into the office, no proof that the landlords or anyone working for them did anything or didn't do anything that directly led to the money disappearing.
So just the fact that the money was gone and the landlords had, you know, some way to get into the office, that wasn't enough to automatically pin negligence on them.
Nope. The court wasn't about to assume negligence. As the case brief points out, the tenants, it was their job to prove there's a straight line from the landlords being negligent to them losing that money, and they just didn't do it. This shows us something really important about landlord-tenant law. Landlords aren't automatically responsible for every single thing that happens on their property. Unless you can clearly prove they were negligent, they're not on the hook for every loss.
Gotcha. So the bailment argument tanked because there wasn't that exclusive control. And the negligence claim didn't work because the tenants couldn't really link the landlord's actions or lack of action to the theft itself. So for, let's say, law students trying to wrap their heads around this stuff, what are the big key legal principles that stand out from this case?
There are a few, yeah. Broadus lays out some really important things. First off, it establishes this absolute need for total exclusive possession and control if you're going to say a bailment exists. If the owner can still get to their property, no dice. Second, if you're saying someone was negligent, you've got to prove it. Just having a hunch or pointing to the fact that someone could have done something wrong, that's not enough in the eyes of the law. And finally, this case really reinforces that a typical landlord-tenant relationship, where the landlord might be able to get in for repairs or cleaning, that doesn't automatically mean we've got a bailment situation.
Thinking about all this, it seems like having a super clear, super specific lease agreement is even more important than maybe we realized before, right?
Oh, absolutely. Lease agreements, they often lay out exactly who's responsible for security and who's liable if a tenant's property gets damaged or goes missing. Broadus really highlights the difference between a landlord having, like, limited access for stuff like repairs versus having the kind of exclusive control that would make a bailment happen. It shows that usually tenants are the ones responsible for protecting their own stuff within their rented space, unless the lease says otherwise, or they can really prove that the landlord was negligent and that negligence led to the loss. So, yeah, being crystal clear in that lease agreement can prevent a lot of these headaches down the line.
Now, there's this hypothetical scenario in the suggested narrative flow materials we've got. It asks, what if the landlords had taken a more direct approach? Like, what if they locked up the tenant safe? Would that have changed things, legally speaking?
Ooh, now that's interesting. If the landlords stepped in and locked the safe in a way that the tenants couldn't get to it themselves, yeah, it could definitely shift things when it comes to that idea of control. It makes you think, right, would that kind of action mean they were taking on more responsibility for what was inside the safe? It wouldn't automatically create a bailment. The whole context of the relationship would still matter, of course, but it definitely bolsters the argument that the landlords were exerting more control over that particular item, and that could mean they had a greater duty to take care of it. It's one of those little nuances that shows how specific actions can really impact the legal relationship and who might be liable.
Okay, so let's distill this down to the real takeaway, especially for our listeners who are, you know, deep in their law studies. Mm-hmm. What's the big core lesson in Broadus v. Commercial National Bank? What should they walk away remembering?
Broadus boils down to this. If you're going to say a bailment exists, it all comes down to exclusive control. A landlord who can get to a tenant's stuff, but not in a way that prevents the tenant from getting to it too, that landlord probably won't be seen as a bailee, and they probably won't be held responsible if something gets stolen. And if a tenant wants to claim their landlord was negligent and cost them something, they've got to back it up. Suspicions and opportunity aren't enough. They need hard evidence that ties the landlord's actions or inactions directly to that specific loss.
That's perfect. Couldn't have said it better myself. And that actually sparks a bigger question, doesn't it? Thinking about this whole exclusive control thing, where else in the world of law does this concept matter? It feels like it could reach far beyond just landlord-tenant disputes.
You're absolutely right. It pops up everywhere. Property law, when we're talking about who owns what and who possesses what. Contract law, thinking about the transfer of goods or responsibilities. Even tort law, when you're dealing with those duties of care. Understanding how exclusive control works in all these different areas can really deepen your grasp of legal reasoning and how courts approach those relationships and responsibilities. Take something like constructive possession in criminal law, for example. A lot of times, that hinges on the idea of having the power to control something, even if you don't physically have it in your hand.
Excellent point. Shows just how broadly relevant this concept can be. Well, I hope our deep dive into Broaddus v. Commercial National Bank has given you a good foundation on landlord liability, the ins and outs of bailment, and how important evidence is when you're talking negligence. But this is just the tip of the iceberg, folks. We always encourage you to dig deeper, explore more cases, and keep learning about these legal principles. Thanks for joining us. Now, I gotta ask, how do you think the rise of all these short-term rental platforms is changing things? How are those platforms affecting traditional ideas about landlord and tenant responsibilities and control? That's something to ponder, especially as the law keeps evolving.
It really is.
And on that note, we'll wrap up here. Until next time.
See you then.